Welcome, dear listener, to this special episode of The Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. As a regular listener, you'd be aware that we started the series with episode 2 because episode 1 found its way to the editing room floor, from which it never recovered until now. So what I've done is I've dusted it off and removed the worst of the bits, and we've got it here for you today. So there's still pretty scratchy audio on it, so apologies for that. We've performed something of a resurrection with this, which, Jesus did it in 3 days, and look, it's taken us about 3 months, but we've gotten there eventually. So sit back and enjoy the famous or infamous episode 1.
Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organized as Bill Heffernan's cognitive reasoning, broadcast via the internet, we're bringing you news, views, opinions on politics, business, and society in general from a couple of blokes who are old enough to recognise this sound. You're listening to The Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Well, I'll insert a drum roll at this point, perhaps.
Fair enough, then. Yeah. So, Glove, this is your intellectual love child, and you're the brains of the outfit. What are you hoping to achieve?
But hang on. I'm the Iron Fist.
Well, oh, sorry. I got that backwards then. That was a complete cock-up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Fist?
So I'm the Iron Fist. Let's get that straight. I want everybody to know it.
Right.
Now, look, what are we hoping to achieve?
Who's the audience?
There's young folk out there, Scott.
Yep.
They're younger than you and I. They're in their 20s and their 30s.
Geez, that was a long time ago, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
And they're hard to get hold of. Like, they don't read newspapers. They don't read my emails. They probably don't read e-newsletters, but they're sitting somewhere on a train commuting to work or the coffee shop or the university or the, I don't know, do they go to rallies anymore? Where would young people go? But they're on these things, and they've got an earphones in their head, and they're listening to podcasts, I think, some of them.
Right. Okay.
So if we can just get some thoughts into their heads about a few things that, if we can indoctrinate them into our views, then that will be perfect.
Good start. Good day.
But that's my aim, is a simple indoctrination session for the young people of Australia to have them thinking my way. And it's a simple aim, and I'm being honest. There you go.
The Bolsheviks started with only a dozen hidden somewhere in a Moscow pub. So
yes.
Look at the havoc they wreaked. So.
So there will be lots of secular issues. I mean, that's what we're about, is what are the things that the party's interested in and what's it doing and what are its ideas? What's going on in the world, if you look at it through secular tinted glasses, that's kind of what we're on about in this podcast.
Absolutely. So news of the last 24 hours. Uh-huh. One of the Prime Minister Abbott came close to a meltdown today over the national broadcaster when one of his backbenchers accused the ABC of being seditious. Did you see that, the episode of Q&A in question?
Can I make a confession about Q&A?
not your favourite?
The whole design of it. Like, I mean, you have a panel of people answering a question, and then you have the follow-up question provided by a different panel in the audience. How can you ever get a coherent line of argument about anything on that show? Like,
no,
you're battling, you're battling to make sense. I mean, you have to stay lightweight and you have to make pithy little comments and little sound bites because
absolutely
you can't move through a progression of thought on that show. The unfortunate thing is it's the best thing that we've got going around where things are actually discussed. I mean, that's how bad the situation is, that a format as appalling as that is
it's the best of a bad lock, really, isn't it?
So I did actually, I saw the start of it, I saw who was going to be on it, and I thought, well, that's going to be pretty boring, and I turned it off and went to bed. And a mistake.
Well, I must admit, I never watch it live. As embarrassing as this sounds, I sound an awful lot like my father. I just don't get Twitter. I must learn how to use it. But the sort of continuous line of tweets across the bottom of the TV screen, it's people have got far too much time on their hands. And I think they've gone far too shallow in a lot of it. You know, my impression of Q&A when I used to watch it on religiously every Monday night was something that, yeah, that's a good start, where you would get part of the way into the introduction to a problem and you could actually have a decent conversation about somewhere. But then, of course, you know, if it was on commercial networks where you'd hit the commercial break, but here it is, it's 10:35, it's time for bed, and the ABC's turned off. But, you are right. Your criticisms are bang on. You only look at what the big problems are. And anyway, I'm sure you've read all the follow-up work on it, but the one bloke that was convicted, I believe it was 2003, was when he was originally hauled before the courts, but he pleaded guilty to one charge because they couldn't make the more serious charges stick. He turned up in the audience and he asked the question of Chobo whether or not, if his case was being handled now, whether or not Chobo thought that what the court gave him, and Chobo looked him in the eye and said, actually, here is the exact quote, "But I'm happy to look you straight in the eye and say that I would be pleased to part of a government that would say that you were out of the country. I would sleep very soundly at night with that point of view." And he then responded, and I am paraphrasing here because I haven't got the exact quote, that this minister and this government has just justified the reasons why young Muslims in Australia are leaving to join ISIL. And Tony Jones at that point then ruled the comment out of order and shut it down. And of course, then which is a peculiar line from any government, to say that anyone that criticises them is anti-Australian. Rather than being critical of the government, you're apparently being critical of Australia. The criticism was not that a convicted criminal had made it on to the show, as Tony Abbott's criticism was. And he pointed out that commercial networks fall over themselves to interview convicted criminals, and the host, whose name escapes me, said, yes, well, Darren Hinch has got his own show, and which I thought was a damn good point. Did you hear today, now, I've got to admit I was fairly busy today, so I didn't get a hell of a lot of time, even at lunchtime, to read the news. I gather in the last 24 hours, two Australian jihadis have gone to meet their maker in either Syria or Iraq.
Yes.
Now, one of them had a wife that had travelled over there with him. Now, apparently the government's playing hardball on her not being allowed back in the country, and her mother has appealed to Abbott, saying, for God's sake, let her come home and let her bring the kids back. Is that the case, or was it?
I think
the wrong end of the stick there.
Look, I think in relation to kids, you just can't deny kids coming back, and I can't then. At the end of the day, I think these people have to come back and face a trial.
And I tend to agree with you. I mean, and to be honest, I think even those that are dual citizens, you know, and I know this isn't a popular view, but as far as I'm concerned, we've taken them on there. Our responsibility, our problem.
Yep.
That I think they've got to come back. They've got to face.
I mean, the calibre of minister that we have in any government these days is not someone that you can trust with important decisions.
There's not many of them that are intellectual giants, are they?
Yeah. I mean, you just can't trust these sorts of people with such important decisions, and I don't trust them, and I think the only course of action is to bring if these people come back, then they come back, and we put them before a court and make the allegations that we have and let a court decide. I mean, that's the doctrine of the separation of powers. That's how our society is supposed to work.
Something that evolved from the events of 800 years ago, about a fortnight ago, when they first signed the Magna Carta. Now, the burden of proof right from that point, if I understand it, had been on the state, not on the accused. Mm. And just to I think it sets a dangerous precedent. And anyway, and, you know, all jokes aside about the individual personalities involved, I don't think it's wise to put that, you know, the power of citizenship in one person's hands.
Yeah, we'd be mad to. So bring them back. Bring them back, try them, and if they've done bad things, then they'll be found guilty and dealt with. And it's up to the system to prove it.
Exactly, and I did find it somewhat disturbing when you had a Prime Minister saying, you know, not just a thought bubble in behind closed doors, but in front of cameras, where he said, well, you know, what happens if we can't get convictions? Wouldn't that be a terrible thing? You know, just to sort of prejudge these things before, you know, it's all fair, well and good to joke about lawyers holding the process up until you're the one that's actually looking for process.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned this in a secular party meeting as well, on this topic of dual nationality. Like, why do we have it? I don't understand dual nationality.
I don't get it either. And I keep going back to the example my old man loves to trot out. Now, he's an old conservative, but he said to me once, he said, when Rupert Murdoch wanted to buy an American newspaper, they wouldn't sell to anyone unless you're an American, and you couldn't have dual nationality.
Exactly.
He had to renounce his Australian citizenship.
Yes.
Now, if it's good enough for the Yanks to do it, and, you know, and they're not alone. The Dutch do it too. If you take out citizenship of someone else, you lose your citizenship of the Netherlands. And so I'm not convinced that I know it's a biblical quote, but I'm not convinced a man can have two masters.
Yeah. The Americans changed their tune on that, so they do now allow
dual
nationality.
You can now have,
but
you're
dead right.
Dual nationality now.
Yeah, but you're dead right. Rupert Murdoch had to renounce his Australian citizenship, and I just don't understand. If somebody's a dual national, then what happens when two countries go to war? Like, it's not impossible, and who are they?
It's not impossible.
What happens then? So,
thought bubble, sketch and paper, but that nonsense of means testing access to state schools. I mean, it'll just ghettoise the public system. You'll end up being the education of last resort, because those people that have got the influence and money to make the system actually better than just third world standards, cash to Nudgee instead of East Brisbane High. I thought it was a ridiculous thing to do. I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's symptomatic of people no longer expecting to pay into the common good.
Yes.
And I have heard a lot of it amongst my own friends who have said, well, I don't have kids. Why the bloody hell should I be paying for other people to have their kids? And why should I be paying for them to be educated? Well, in a society where we've got far too much illiteracy, is not going to be pretty to live in. And if the level of inequality continues to go on its current trajectory, you know, that won't be good for anyone, especially if that working poor turns into revolution, because revolutions are never good for the share market.
Well, there was a lady, harking back to Q&A, who was speaking about poverty in America, I believe.
Yes, she's a book, that's on Late Night Live.
Yes.
Well, the podcast of it, but she was very interesting, wasn't she?
She was, and
did she recount the story of when she was pregnant and was both her and her husband were basically destitute, and she went to a charity-run welfare people asking if she can get a chair that she can actually sit down on rather than having to sit down on the floor while she was pregnant?
Yes, and what was their answer?
Yeah. Well, they said they're happy for her to go there when they give it to her, but she has to... it's sort of like mutual obligation on steroids is what I understand it.
Yes.
In that they said to her, if you want this help, that's fine, but you've got to go and to this class on resume writing. And
that's right. And she said, yes. The class was only on when she was working, And exactly. She said, so you want me to quit my job so I can go to a resume writing class to apply for a job.
To find for a job, that one that I've just quit. Yeah. Yeah, now that is just madness.
Yeah. But I think what we need to do in this country, Scott, is explain to people what it's like to be poor in America.
Yes.
And how easily people can end up in that situation in America, and say, is that what you want in Australia? Because
exactly.
It's a fundamental question is, do we want to follow the American model, or do we want to follow more of a European, Scandinavian model?
And if we go down the Scandinavian path, I'm not sure you want it to be cradle to grave welfare, but it's... you don't want that sort of Darwinian survival of the fittest that they have on the other side of the Atlantic either.
Yeah. Here's what happens is there's lots of studies have shown that where there is inequality, then there is unhappy societies.
Exactly.
And the more equal societies are, the happier they are. So when you look at world happiness indexes, you see all of these really struggling poor countries that actually have high levels of happiness. And the main reason behind that is you as Joe Blow doing your job, look around and see that pretty much everybody else is in your predicament, living at the same sort of standard, and your normal is their normal, and you don't have a sense of resentment. Whereas in somewhere like America, you can be struggling washing dishes for $7 an hour, and yet you will see the expensive cars, the expensive homes, the expensively dressed people all around you, and it's rubbed into your face all the time that you're in fact at this low level and there are all these other people at a higher level.
Yeah.
And that makes people unhappy, believe it or not.
Surprisingly makes them unhappy. It also makes, you know, and, you know, I realise that in a country like Australia, a revolution is highly unlikely. But, you know, if you look back on the history, Imperial Russia, Imperial China, when you had the absolute dirt poor and the incredibly filthy rich,
yes,
people get very resentful, and that's when they, you know, when push then comes to shove. And
In the late night live interview with this Linda Tirado,
were you listening to it live, or were you listening to Philip Adams on podcast as I was?
I was listening on podcast.
Yes.
Philip Adams made the point that there was some American billionaire who's basically going around telling people in America, you realise that the poor people outnumber us, and at some point there could be a revolution, and it's not going to be pretty, and... basically promoting the idea that it's in the interests of rich people that, in fact, there's a bit more equality because they run a risk of a revolution.
Well, not only do they run a risk of a revolution, you know, I mean, I'm a hard-headed accountant, and when you go back and you look at the history of the Western world, its most prosperous time was in that post-war period, especially in the United States, where they were the world's creditor and the world's exporter. And, you know, lower than what it is now. I mean, in any capitalist system, you're always going to have the well-to-do and the haves and the have-nots. There's got to be a gap between rich and poor. If there's no gap, then no one bothers for doing the extra hours at the factory or anything like that. They don't bother trying to get ahead because it's impossible. Yeah. Conversely, if that gap between rich and poor is no longer a gap and becomes a chasm, then people realise that they no longer buy into the lie that it's possible to keep up with the Joneses, and they just don't bother.
Mm.
And if they...
My favourite statistic on this is that in the 60s, your classic middle-class worker was a Detroit auto worker who was, if you allow for inflation, would have been earning the equivalent in today's dollars of $60,000 plus getting healthcare. Yeah. Now,
and they had a pension plan that looked after them when they got old, too.
Now, that middle-class worker, or that that working class person in America now is a Walmart worker who is earning $18,000 a year and no government, no medical benefits. And so that's what's happened to the middle class. The middle class in America has disappeared. And this whole notion of trickle down is rubbish.
It doesn't trickle down. And this is something the Pope once said, which I know for a pair of secularists, he's not the best person to quote, but...
Episode one, and we're favourably quoting the Pope. Who would have thought?
Yeah, I know, it's a problem, isn't it? The Pope once said, he said, the problem with trickle-down economics, we were told that once the rich had filled their glass, that it would trickle down to everyone else. What we discovered was that the rich just bought bigger glasses.
The Pope said that.
Yes, the Pope said that. Now, I'm pretty sure it was this one. I don't think it was the German before him. But
No, it sounds like the current one. If any Pope was going to say it, it would be the current one, I guess. We should name him. What's his name? Give him a...
Francis.
Francis, there we go.
Francis, the current one's Francis. The one before that was Benedict. And then the one before that was John Paul, wasn't it? John Paul was the one who died in... Well, they all died in office. Last one was the only one that had resigned, but that was because the sex abuse scandals were getting too close to it.
Yeah. Another disclosure, I was raised a Catholic, and at some point in a future podcast, we will discuss my baptism as a Christian, but we'll leave that for the moment. So
you haven't renounced that baptism yet, though, Trevor, I tell you?
I don't know where you go to renounce it.
Well, I don't know.
There is an idea. We should encourage a renunciation ceremony for Catholics or any other denomination, because the Catholic Church isn't going to organise one, but in the secular movement could have a renunciation ceremony where we...
You know when in the 80s those mass weddings were all the rage in Korea? We could have a mass anti-baptism.
I think,
where thousands of people stand underneath the sprinkler and say, we reject the word of God.
We're needing some sort of publicity, and I think if we were to help people with a mass renunciation...
To cast off those golden handcuffs?
Yeah. Because, I've got a certificate. I've got a baptism. Well, my mother's got it somewhere from her. Like, I've got a birth certificate. I've got a baptism certificate. I've got a confirmation certificate. But I can't obtain a renunciation certificate. There is no there's no divorce paper that I can sign between the Catholic Church and myself. And I think, we could just charge a nominal fee for the proceeds going to the secular party.
Or to help the unfortunate victims of the Catholic Church when they try to, all the disclosures that are coming out of the room.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's got a lot. I'll put that on my list.
That's got legs, and that should go on the back burner for further discussion, and it could evolve into something, yes.
Yes, that could.
At this point, dear listener, I'll interrupt with an important update. Now, having listened to episode one, I was reminded about the renunciation certificate and thought that maybe I could rustle one up in some fashion. So the good news is it's now possible. If you are a member of the Catholic Church, you can log on to the ironfistvelvetglove.com.au website, and you'll see a link there in the menu for the renunciation certificate. And as a Catholic, you can answer a few simple questions there and then submit and then click on something else, and voila, you will receive your very own renunciation certificate. A few simple questions, and I encourage you to access that and print out your certificate and pin it up on the wall and look at it occasionally and give thanks to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove for the fine public service that we are offering. Back to the regular part of episode one.
I also, listening to podcasts, as people will soon gather, I am I've got a job where I drive around a fair bit. So I refuse to listen to the radio and tune into podcasts. And another one from I feel like genuflecting when I say Philip Adams, because he is a national treasure. Like, he honestly...
He is a national treasure. He's one of the few people in the country that is prepared to openly admit that he is a Bolshevik. He is still a member of that failed religion.
And, you know, he's just heart's in the right place, smart guy, and doing a good service there. Anyway, one of his other podcasts...
Oh, look, I've got to respect the man. I really do. I mean, I don't agree with him a lot of the time. No, sorry. On social issues, I agree with him. On economic issues, I don't agree with him. But he's always got a reasoned argument for his position, and I admire intelligence.
Yes. So he was interviewing, he was talking about a lady who, I'll get her name, is Beta Sarota Gordon. And she was a Jewish girl raised in Japan who went to America when she was sort of 16 to further her education. And at that point, war broke out. So she
She was interned then.
Well, no, she was in America then, so she was...
But she would have been interned in America as a Japanese citizen, wouldn't she?
Well, no, I think she was a Jewish citizen.
Oh, so she was an American Jew living in Japan.
It takes up the story... I think she was a European Jew living in Japan.
Right.
And her parents stayed in Japan, sent her to the States for her education. War broke out. Her parents, he was a famous musician. He was interned in Japan. It wasn't a concentration camp, but it was unpleasant. Anyway, because she had lived in Japan, she was completely fluent in Japanese. So at the end of the war, when they were drafting the constitution of the new Japan, she was deeply involved as an interpreter. And in that role, she managed to put forward elements of the new constitution that were a great leap forward for women's rights in Japan. So prior to that time...
That would be a really fascinating story. It would be.
Prior to that time, Japan was very paternalistic or patriarchal. So
patriarchal is probably a better term, yeah.
I think so. We'll go with that. So, for example, women couldn't inherit property. And if there was a divorce, it was extremely difficult. They couldn't get the kids. And there were all sorts of things in the system that made it very, very difficult for women. And she had observed this in her childhood and adolescence, growing up in Japan, visiting friends and noting the comparison to her own household. So when she was this interpreter, she managed to get things included into the new Japanese constitution to fix these things up.
Yeah.
So where I'm heading with this, so things like equality between the sexes was then put into the Japanese constitution. Now, could you imagine that happening today? I mean, the uproar from the liberal left, who would say, well, this is, you know, a part of the culture of Japan. You can't take that away. You can't go in and just change their society like that. Like, it wouldn't be allowed. And the classic example, recent experience of this, is Iraq. So
absolutely.
We go in, invade, make a big mess, get the chance to create a new constitution.
AKA West Germany.
And here again, similar situation, misogyny ruling.
Yeah.
Now, had it been 19...
to be fixed.
Had it been 1946 instead of 2005 or whatever it was, we would have said, you know what, this misogyny, it's over. It's done with.
Yeah.
We're putting in some rules here, and it's all finished. But instead, what do we get? I'm looking at Wikipedia now, the Iraq Constitution, third line that it's got here. Islam is the state religion and a basic foundation for the country's laws, and no law may contradict the established provisions of Islam.
Yeah. absurd. So then, you know, you just...
But here's the difference. So 1946, you guys are stuffed, we're in control, you've got some really bad ideas, we're going to wipe them out. And
this is why
you took
your nation to war, because you had a stuffed social structure.
Exactly. And yet, on something like Iraq, we go in, we make a mess, and do we fix it? No.
Wash your hands of it and walk away and then say, oh, God, look what happened. Yeah.
At this point, Scott, I'd love to play my soundbite. So by next time, I will work out how to do this and I'll run the same subject. And it would fit in quite nicely. But...
Well, dear listener, since those early days, I have actually managed to work out how to insert little audio clips. So here is the clip. It's from Donald Rumsfeld addressing the troops, and it's quite interesting. Here it is.
Carefully. Promise. There's a hand. That looks like a woman.
It is. I am a woman. Thank you.
I'm not going to catch the Dickens now, see?
I'm Deborah Nelson, Captain, Nurse Corps from Salinas, California. And Mr. Secretary, none of us wants to win the war and lose the peace. How can we create a stable transitional government in Iraq, should Saddam be replaced, that would improve world peace and not foster chaos and terrorism?
Where's a man?
What are we doing there? It's just a waste of human life.
Look, it is, and I got to admit, when it was first starting to boil over, I thought to myself, no, we've got to be part of this. This is something that humanity is going to have to stand up to. But it's like my loving partner. He said to me a couple of months ago, this is when I first started to turn around on my thinking of it all, he says, you've got to remember, whoever wins, they're not going to like us.
And on that abrupt note, dear listener, we shall end the infamous episode one, and we'll return to normal podcasting next time. Bye. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone. And just put the word out. The other thing is, you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.